Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
So another great set of results from Keywords. Particularly pleasing for us is the fact that our organic revenue is up 17% this year. Again, we're giving you the like-for-like measure, but it's worth noting that there hasn't been that much acquisition impact on these numbers this year. So that is a much sort of cleaner organic measure than perhaps you're used to seeing. And top line up 39%. Adjusted EBITDA again up nicely, and profit before tax up 15.5%. So what I really want to talk about is what's behind some of these numbers. So organic growth of 17.3%. What that looks like is particularly strong growth in a couple of our areas of business: functional testing, game development services, which we used to call engineering, and also in our art business. And it's also come with some considerable cross-selling in our business. As you know, one of the things that we are very successful at doing is selling across our seven service lines. And the measure that we provide for that is the number of clients that buy three or more services. But if you look below those as well, and we don't have the numbers to share with you, but what you see is nice steady progress in the number of clients buying four services, buying five services, and buying seven services. So very good year-on-year progression, confirming the sort of Keyword story. A feature of this year as well has been the amount of investment we've put into the business to support the growth that we're experiencing. So as all of this demand is coming to us, we have two choices. One is, do we try and do everything we can to capture that demand, or do we sit back and let it pass us by? So obviously we choose to make the investments so that we can take on the work. And what that has involved is this year we're adding 1,400 workstations, which is roughly a 25% increase in the number of workstations. That doesn't equate directly to a 25% increase in capacity across the business, because those workstations are more geared to certain types of activities than others. But it is an indication of the confidence we have in the business and where it's going and the demand that we're seeing. We've also continued to strengthen the management in the business, which has led to a bit of an increase in the OPEX cost. And that, together with the cost of expanded facilities, are what weighing on that OPEX cost. So you'll see, as we get into the details of the margins, which David will get onto later on, is you're seeing our first half margin of about 12%, operating margin of 12%, which is a bit down on what it's been previously. And the reason for that is precisely this sort of level of activity and the level of growth that we're experiencing. So if you think about our normal operating margins of around 15%, what you've got going on here is you've got about a percentage of margin that's going into this very high ramp up in resource to capture what has been a faster and steeper growth curve in the first half of the year. So somewhere in here we talk about the number of people, but the average number of people in the business at the moment is about 6,500 people. That's up over 1,000 people on this time last year. So as you ramp up and you're recruiting and you're doing that very, very fast, you're obviously training, you've got recruiting costs, and then you've probably got a bit more churn than you would normally have if you were able to ramp up in a more sort of smoother fashion. So that impacts your gross margin. And then we've also called out an underperforming contract in our game development services, which was a contract we inherited through an acquisition. We're getting to the end of that contract at the moment, but that's been a bit of a drag on gross and net margin. And then this sort of addition of the OPEX costs. So our OPEX costs have probably risen about a percentage point of revenues, where we normally would try and maintain that under the 20% level. It's gone above that this year, as we've invested in senior mid-level management, plus those expanded facilities. And the other thing that you're seeing, of course, in the numbers is some impact from acquisitions. I think we've made 5 acquisitions today, to date, the most recent of which we've just announced today, which is the acquisition of TVS, which is an audio business based in Berlin. And one of the features of that is it takes us just a little bit further into the market of TV and film subtitling and dubbing, which is the neighboring activity that we do in games, which we call localization and voiceover. It's pretty much the same thing, but in a different market. Although it's geared, obviously, to provide us with operational capacity for the voiceover work that we have in games currently in Germany, some of which we're actually outsourcing to third parties because we have a relatively small presence in Germany at the moment for that activity. And the other thing on the acquisition side is just to give you a very quick update on where we are with some of the larger acquisitions that we've done. So talking first of all, and hopefully for the last time, about VMC, which we acquired back in 2017, which remains our largest acquisition to date. That was fully bedded down, fully integrated by the end of 2018. I think we already messaged that that was producing group level margins, which is a considerable improvement from where it was pre-acquisition. And the other thing that it's doing is brought us real scale in our functional testing business. So when you see this very strong growth in functional testing, a lot of that is actually down to the fact that we've now consolidated a number of these functional testing businesses in North America to become the go-to player. So we benefit from that, that scale and consolidation. The other acquisition that we've done, which was of bigger size, was Studio Gobo and Electric Square, game development business based in Brighton. Now, that has performed very well, and I think David and his colleagues are just finalizing the numbers at the moment for the purpose of the earn-out, but you can expect them to receive the deferred consideration associated with that acquisition. So we're delighted with that performance. Just quick one, setting up the market dynamics as we see them at the moment. So the video games market, as you all know, is fast moving, both in terms of growth and in terms of what's happening within it, in terms of new platforms and all the rest of it. So this year, I suppose the news in the games market has been about streaming of games, people trying to become the Netflix of video games. So Google Stadia launching their, Google launching their streaming service Stadia, and Apple launching their Apple Arcade game service. Both of those, current. And then the other news that's happening is that we're going through a console transition. So we're moving from PlayStation 4 and Xbox One to the next generation of those devices. So PlayStation 5 and whatever the new Xbox is going to be called. That's a transition that's happening at the moment. So the market expects those devices to... you've got a whirring noise or something you're trying to fix? So the market expects those new devices probably to launch towards the end of next year. And I'll talk a little bit about the impact of those, both of those, later on. As I said, we have the 7 services. We've renamed engineering to game development. That's, I think, an attempt to try and help people understand exactly what that activity is. But it's exactly the same. There's no change. It's the same businesses. We've continued to develop those organically, growing our team of developers as rapidly as we can to fulfill the demand, which is far exceeding our ability to supply. And the other one to call out is our marketing services business, which is currently under the art service line, and was demonstrated a little bit by the trailer I played at the beginning. And that's another area of the business which continues to grow well and hopefully will receive the benefit of further acquisitions. Geographically, we are in all the territories where we want to be. If I would give you one thing to concentrate on this slide, it's just how successful we've been at leveraging our presence in the various markets to spin up services in those areas. So a simple example is if you look at Tokyo, we're currently providing 6 services from Tokyo. We started that business totally organically with just a single service. Same as if you look at Montreal and Singapore and elsewhere, we've been very good at leveraging the HR teams, the facilities, the IT, the security and everything that we've got in those locations. And that's a tremendous asset. You know, it's I come across businesses that are talking about making their first sort of international moves and how difficult it is for them to actually try and get their heads around, you know, going from the west coast of the US to the UK, for instance, and how big an issue that is for them. We're doing it all the time in our business. As you know, we provide these services to pretty much the who's who of the video games industry. This is just one view of the penetration we have in the industry, but pretty much all major game companies, developers and publishers will use some of Keyword services. So coming back to the sort of financial trends in the business, the strong growth, as you can see, year on year, continues to be a very impressive picture with all the lines pointing to the top right-hand corner, which is what I always like to see. Obviously, in the blue, those are half-year numbers rather than full-year numbers, the exception to that being the rolling 12-month view of return on capital employed in the last of those 4 charts. But again, if you take those blue lines and you kind of double them in your head, you'll get a sense as to where the trends lie for the full year. This next slide I tend to regard as a bit of a slide that talks to the quality of the business, the solidity of the business, if you like. So coming back to the console transition point that I mentioned earlier, if you look at the last transition cycle, which was back in 2013 when the Xbox One came out and the PlayStation 4 came out. At that point in time, I think Keywords was exposed to two or three large customers to the extent of more than 60% of its business, 2 of those being Sony and Microsoft. And that transition certainly in one of those cases was a bit of a troubled transition. And that affected us because of that exposure that we had to those clients to the extent that we have. Today, we have no single client accounting for more than 6% of our revenue. So it's a very different business today than it was 7 years ago. And with that as well comes the fact that, you know, we're more embedded in our clients. And by that, I mean we are providing value at a sort of higher level in the organization. So we will do a lot more kind of PMing, project management type services to our clients rather than them just throwing work over the fence and us throwing it back. We're more integrated into their systems, into their game development pipelines. We have access to their game engines and all that sort of thing, which is a big step from where we were at the time of IPO. And then the other bit of news on the client side is obviously as you move from selling a single service to selling 4, 5, 6, 7 services. So your relevancy to the client increases and you become far more strategic as far as they're concerned. So all of that is very positive in my eyes. And then the final point I would draw your attention to on this chart is what's happening with game development over here on the far right. So this is an activity we've only really been in for a couple of years. And already it's growing to be one of our biggest neck and neck between that and functional testing as to which will be our biggest service line this year. So really, really strong growth. Again, that's a service which is, it receives attention of game producers and CEOs in a way that perhaps localization and testing doesn't. So I'm not saying it's necessarily a more valuable service, but certainly in terms of the eyes of the client, it gets a lot more attention than some of the other services do. And that's a good thing for us. So looking at the at the balance of the business and how the pizza is now sliced. As you can see, if you think about our business going back 10 years or more, this area of localization was the sort of founding pillar of Keywords. Now, testing and game development are bigger than that activity. And it's not because that other activity has failed to grow. Quite the opposite. It's been a very strong growth performer year on year. But some of the other areas are growing faster. And some of them are benefiting more from a more recent trend towards outsourcing. That's certainly the case of game development that historically wasn't outsourced much at all. Same is true of functional testing, particularly in the West, where that has continued to be very much an in-house activity and is really now starting to benefit from people constraining their own sort of investments in game testing and using more outsourced provision for that. Very small sprinkling of the titles that we work on currently, but every year we're very fortunate as a business to get to work on the world's leading video games across the world. So whether that's in Japan, whether it's in China, whether it's in the US or UK. And that is part of what makes working at Keywords that's what attracts people to work at Keywords, and that's what keeps people working at Keywords, is this variety of games that they just cannot find anywhere else. If you're working at one of our clients, you'd be working on usually the same titles every couple of years or whatever, but the range of titles that come across Keywords desk is unparalleled. So I'm going to stand back and let David talk you through the more detailed parts of the financials.
Thanks, Andrew. So I think Andrew's kind of touched already on a lot of what's in the physical numbers itself. Obviously, we're very pleased to see the revenue up so strongly, just shy of 40%. I think it really is underpinned by the fact that we've seen the strong like-for-like growth up 17%, the cross-sell performing so well up 14%, the strong performance of the individual service lines like FQA, engineering, and art, and equally the fact that the revenue is performing strongly in terms of growth terms in each of the service lines, you know, at its lowest 5%, at its highest north of 30%. So I think you're seeing all these other factors underlying, you know, underpinning this and this strong growth in the first half of the year. Obviously, in delivering that growth and chasing that revenue and chasing that opportunity, we've sacrificed a bit of gross margin. You've seen part of the principal reasons behind this are the rapid recruitment and training, building out some of the additional IT, HR, support functions to help deliver and support the size of organization in the first half. Staffing for the new facilities, again, we've massive expansion, creating nearly 1,400 seats, only of which about 200 were occupied by the end of the first half of the year. And then obviously, Andrew's talked about the individual contract that came in through an acquisition and its impact. Moving on down then to the operating costs, again, our internal target would be to hit about 20% of revenues in terms of our long-term target and our traditional metric. It's obviously trending slightly above that. Some of the factors in terms of scaling up and growth are driving that. We'd expect that to kind of come back down. The year-end figure will probably still sit above the 20%, though, as a result of the first half impact. EBITDA, profit before tax, again, all performing strongly year on year. The adjusted effective tax rate, obviously what you would have seen in full years and half years previously is that we've been making steady kind of progress. You see somewhere up to about 1% decrease I think our long-stated aim previously was that we would land somewhere in the kind of mid-teens in terms of our effective tax rate, primarily as a function of the blend and the diversity of the group and the geographic reach that we have. Again, we have an exceptional 500K element of tax charge coming in that relates to a pre-acquisition period. If you strip that out, the progress would have been down to about 17%. So the underlying trend, our structuring is fundamentally sound and directionally going the correct way. Moving on to the balance sheet, again, you know, at this time of year, we're at our lowest point in terms of cash. Kind of harvest the cash in the second half of the year as you come through the peak production. Net debt marginally up where it was at this time last year at 9 million. Most of the outlay has been on 7 million of net cash considerations and just shy of 3 million on acquisition costs and integration expenses on the four acquisitions that we made in the half year. Accrued MMTCs are sitting at 18.2 million at the period end. Just to put this into context, 10.1 million was at the year end of fiscal 18. The increase has primarily come from trading in the first half. That's up strongly versus what we accrued in last year, which was only about 3.7 million. So quite a steep rise. That's primarily out of our activities in Montreal, where we received the MMTC credit, and FQA, which has grown strongly in one of those prime locations, again, which is Montreal. Capital expenditure, I think at the full year, we would have guided you to a similar level of spend, about 9, 10 million in the year. We've done a significant proportion of that already in the first half at 5.1 million, up on where it was last year. Testing, art and game development, again, the service lines which are growing strongly, being the principal service lines being recipients of that investment, and locations such as Manila, Montreal, Mexico City and Katowice being the sites where we've grown to help support those and other service lines. Cash flow, again, traditionally when you see it as us at the H1, we're at our kind of low point, cash conversion is generally lower, and it's the second half where you see a large step up. Again, touched on the fact that we've accrued nearly 6.9 million in the period in terms of MMTCs and VGTR. We're continuing with our progressive dividend policy, which is to be up 10% year on year. I think one thing that's kind of been pleasing as well is that our debtors' days have crept up slightly post the VMC integration. We seem to be through that. The debt collection is working back to its more kind of normalized levels, and the progress in that area is back to where it should be. I think probably important to point out as well in the second half of the year, on the balance sheet, you'll see about 18.8 million of deferred considerations. Most of that will be going out in the second half of the year, if not all of it. The lion's share of that going to two of our larger acquisitions that we did previously. Moving on to guidance, again, strong organic and acquisitive growth. We expect that to be slightly slower in H1, but again, for the full year, a strong overall performance. We've had the H1 capacity investments. We expect to benefit from those from a margin perspective in H2 and rolling on and progressing into 2020. And again, we'd look to see that those operating expenses as a percentage of revenues will trend back to the more traditional 20% levels. Again, we'll have the full 6-month contribution from the first half acquisitions. Again, this is our first full year reporting under IFRS 16. So just to remember that you're seeing an inflated depreciation charge, which has an element attributed to it, which would be the traditional kind of lease and rental costs associated with the properties that we're in. Interest expense, to the extent that we utilize our bank facility for acquisitive growth, expect to see that increase. Again, we've opened up the new facility with four supportive banks, Silicon Valley, HSBC, Barclays, and HSBC. Slight reduction in the effective tax rate. Again, we touched on that earlier in terms of the progress that we've already made in H1. And the long-term target, like I said, to be in the kind of mid-teens. And then you should expect to see the seasonal H2 positive cash conversion kind of flow through. I'll hand you back to Andrew.
Thanks, David. So I'll just have a quick flip through some of the operational highlights of the business, and then we'll get on to looking at outlook. So service line by service line, just some color around them. So art services, like-for-like growth of 16%. So again, another very strong performance from this service line, which now does include the three marketing services businesses, which are obviously contributing both to the overall size and overall growth, which is 50% overall revenue growth, but they are growing nicely organically as well. I think in terms of this business, what we should be looking at is that continued good organic growth, but also further acquisitions to come as we expand out that marketing services businesses in particular. And at some point, if we get it to the scale that we would hope it would achieve, then we'll be looking at separating that out as a separate service line so that you can track it a little bit more granular. Game development, next up, previously called engineering. Fantastic performance from this service line, which is benefiting very much from a really marked demand for outsourced support from our game clients. Not only that, but I've been very pleased with the way in which our individual studios have been able to hire into that that demand in their local areas, which, to remind you, in the UK, that's Brighton, where we have three facilities. It's in Liverpool, Runcorn area, where we have D3T. But we're also in Florida. We're also in Ottawa in Canada. And we have our larger single studio in St. Petersburg. We have a good studio in Poland, in Krakow, and we recently made an acquisition over in Japan. So yet again, I think that's showing the strength of Keywords and that we're able to fairly easily acquire and absorb and support these businesses in all these key geographies. It's a real asset of ours. I mentioned it earlier on, and sometimes people look at that map that I showed you and think, oh, that's very complex. But the other way of looking at it, that's a tremendous asset, and you're going to start seeing us leverage that more and more. On our audio services only, 7% like-for-like growth. Of course, in most businesses, that would be a fantastic achievement. And what I would say about this business is that as we go into the second half, this is one area that's being affected a bit more by the console transition that I mentioned earlier. So some of our clients are sort of pausing, if you like, a little bit for thought as to what their strategy is going to be for developing games, either for the new console or for the existing console. And as they sort of pause for thought, that's starting to impact some of those businesses that are more focused on console games than necessarily mobile or PC or whatever. And audio is one of those which you might remember usually has a seasonal peak either just before the half year or just after the half year. This year, we don't expect to see any such seasonal peak because there's been this little sort of hesitation around the console games as to whether to launch them this year or to hold back and launch next year and so on. So that's what we're seeing a little bit, or we believe we're seeing that in the audio services activities. As we move on to functional QA, this is another just absolutely phenomenal performance when you really stop to think what a 30% organic growth looks like in operational terms for a business like this. It's the guys have done an absolutely fantastic job in absorbing all of this incremental demand. And I would encourage you, if you can persuade whoever signs off your expenses at some point, to come and visit the guys over in Montreal just to get a sense for this, for the scale of the operation. It's kind of jaw-dropping and absolutely world-class operations out there of the like that you won't see anywhere else in the world. But, you know, as I said earlier on, that growth, that phenomenal steep increase in activity in the first few months of the year did come at a little bit of a cost to our gross margins, but that's starting to unwind as we settle down into a more sort of steady pattern into the second half of the year. But I expect this business to continue to be a strong growth driver. And we've also, as a result of that, we've also taken decision to invest in some new facilities and operations in both Mexico City, where we had a small presence in our audio business in particular. We're leveraging that sort of local presence, local knowledge, local support infrastructure to build up a bigger FQA presence. We're doing the same thing in Katowice in Poland, where we've previously opened a player support activity. But those sort of organic openings of activities do come at a bit of a cost because you have to staff them and so on before you can start providing any services out of them. So expect further growth. And what we're seeing there is basically a market, at least in the West, that's traditionally been insourced, that is gradually moving towards more and more use of outsourced services. And we're right in the path of that, which is great. Localization, more settled growth from them. You'll be aware that year on year, sometimes they can have a 20% or so like-for-like growth. This year's a little bit more stable. It's coming off the impact that we had from Fortnite and so on last year, which fortunately we're not having to talk much about this year, but just so you understand, that's a business that in terms of its growth was sort of knocked back a bit last year because of some of the disruptive effect of Fortnite. It's now settling down into a sort of steadier growth pattern. Localization QA, which once upon a time, actually not that many years ago, was the biggest activity in Keywords. I think probably at the time of the IPO, it might have been the biggest single activity. That's now looking a little bit underweight within the Keywords overall business. And it's another one of the service lines which is being affected by the console transition. So like the audio business, this is a business where quite a lot of its activity is geared around the big console releases that get perhaps a bit more investment in polish, particularly on the language side of things prior to release. And again, because of the sort of what we perceive to be a slower release pattern coming up to this year in this Christmas, this Thanksgiving period, we're seeing lower demand, or rather I should say we're not seeing the normal sort of seasonal peak of activity that we'd be seeing at this time within the localization QA business. And the final one, which I signaled based on last year's results, is player support, which again, if you remember, went through a tremendous growth spurt in 2018. I said following those results that this was going to be a period of consolidation for player support, and that's what you're seeing in this number. You know, you grow at a tremendous rate. At some point, you have to pause for breath, get everything together, get your facilities and what have you in shape, as we've been doing so with investments in Manila in particular. And then, you know, hopefully we'll see this business grow faster again next year. So just to remind you a little bit of the background to what we're seeing, and again, this is probably easier if I stand up here to show you. So art services, where you've got the sort of 16% like-for-like growth, that's a market which is currently only about 50% outsourced, so there's still a big tailwind to come from further outsourcing rather than insourcing of art services. The game development market here, which actually I suspect is bigger than the 3 billion number we've assigned to it, but this is, you know, going back a few years, there would have been very little outsourcing in game development. It's hard to find a client now that's not asking for outsourced services, or is at least trying to explore how they can tap into outsourced services for game development. And I'm pretty sure that's going to shift dramatically to the right over the years, assuming people like us can grow into that demand and don't constrain it. If you look at audio services, on the other hand, audio services is already mostly outsourced. Having said that, it's still a very fragmented market, so you don't benefit quite as much from the trend towards outsourcing here, but you do have a great growth opportunity, which is to take market share and to consolidate. Functional testing, which is one which I've always found to be a bit odd. I'm not quite sure why this is so insourced as an activity, but only about 30% of functional testing in the West is outsourced. I see no reason why that shouldn't go all the way to the right. And so on. You can see the way the market is playing out. So you can see a lot of that actually in the keywords numbers if you look at it. Hence why we've got these three particularly big growth areas at the moment in our business. Obviously, how we manage our business. Most of you have seen this slide before. Just to signal that we are looking at ways in which we might leverage some of the synergies, the operational synergies within the businesses. So if you look, for instance, at our functional QA business and our localization QA businesses, if you were to visit us in our studios, you would see those as being pretty much the same sort of activity, the difference being that one is staffed by language experts, the other one is staffed by non-language game testers. But there's opportunities potentially to combine some of the management of those businesses and extract some synergies as a result. And the same is true probably of our audio and our localization businesses. If you think that a big chunk of our audio business is actually putting, effectively doing the dubbing for video games, that's an activity where the client is usually the same sort of client. So you're buying, the client is buying, is one buyer, and they're currently buying from two different service lines within Keywords. It might make sense to consolidate that. And as I said, the other one is the marketing services line, which on the other hand might be something that we spin out as a separate service line. Further little note for your consideration is the fact that we're mentioning John Hawke as the incoming new CFO to the business. John's actually kindly here with us today, so sat at the back. He was waving earlier on, but if you want to grab him after this, please do give him a grilling. So we're fully expecting John to join us very soon. So quickly on to outlook. So trading in the second half has started very well. The growth that we've called out in the first half is not temporary growth. You need to really understand this. This is growth that sticks. So this becomes the new base level for Keywords. And then obviously we're looking to grow on top of that. The trend towards outsourcing I've mentioned, we're obviously not going to slow down investment. If investment is needed in order to capture that growth, we won't hesitate at all. As you've seen probably from the CapEx numbers, it's not a hugely capital intensive business in order to flesh out these new workstations. It's operationally demanding, but it's not capital demanding particularly. And so we will continue to grow into the demand. On the acquisitions side of things, you've probably seen that we've been a little bit quieter, albeit we just snuck in an acquisition announcement this morning. We have been a little bit quieter than we would normally be over a sort of 12-month period, but that's not an indication of anything. The pipeline of acquisitions, if anything, is probably healthier than it's been at any time. And it's simply a question of when these acquisitions land rather than us having slowed our sort of appetite or our pace of acquisition growth. So continue to expect us to deliver more earnings enhancing acquisitions as we go through the second half and into 2020. So before I come on to the investment summary, I just want to sort of summarize a little bit the way I see the business over this year. So fantastic top line growth, operating margin a little bit lower than we've traditionally delivered. So if I think about this business as kind of 38% gross margin business, 20% operating costs, leaving 18% EBITDA margin. Reducing to kind of 15% pre-tax profit margin. First half, we've only delivered 12% at that pre-tax profit margin, but again, if you look at the sort of temporary impacts that we've got about a percentage point on the gross margin coming from this very steep growth in the business. We've got a percentage point coming off from the underperforming contract that I mentioned, and David elaborated on as well. And then we've got about a percentage coming off on the operating costs, where additional facilities, temporary space, and so on that we've taken to support the growth, plus investment in mid and sort of senior level management has weighed on those operating costs, which again should unwind next year. So if you start looking into 2020, we fully expect to see our underlying margins come through again at about 15% operating margin next year. So, you know, another way to look at this is all of those margin effects are purely internally or internal. They're fully within our own control. This is not a margin squeeze through some sort of external factors. And then a quick reminder of the investment summary. So the major thing for me is that this is a business which provides investors access to a very large, dynamic, fast-growing market, which is the market for video games. It's a global market. We also benefit from very strong drivers, whether that's market growth, continuous pressure on content, whether that's on the quantity of content or on the quality of content. So as you progress to new consoles, those are more capable devices, and the games become bigger, higher definition, and so on, and that leads to more demand for our services in itself. Our business model and the sort of diversification that we have within the industry across different services and across different geographies, I think, puts us in a very unique position, and we continue to drive towards being this go-to provider for the video games industry. So that's it from me, and I will now stop talking and let you fire questions if you have any.
On localization, is your localization restricted to video games localization, or do you also look at the major content providers for the film and video industries? And
very, very topical question. Thank you very much. It has been really 100% focused on video games. Having said that, we do get some creepage of content which is of a more linear type. So whether it's for animated TV film type work, whether it's voiceover or subtitling for film and television. We do have a very small amount of that business internally, and we do some work for people like Netflix and so on. What we've done, and you don't see, but it's actually part of the investment that we're making in the business, is we actually have a small team now dedicated to that market. I don't want people to start thinking that this is some big bet that we're placing. It's tiny, tiny little baby steps into that market as we sort of explore the possibilities of leveraging the Keywords infrastructure and the expertise that we have in what is essentially the same discipline but applied to a slightly different content type. And we're very pleased with the sort of response we get from people like the over-the-top platform holders, the Amazons, the Netflix, Disneys, and so on, looking for additional suppliers to them that will help them get their content to market faster and in a simultaneous fashion. So there's a marked difference between video game content and that content, in that the film and television content has historically followed a waterfall sort of model where they release first in the US, then they will release in France, then they will release in Germany and so on, whereas video games since the very beginning have always gone into all languages simultaneous. And that's what those new streaming platforms are trying to do. So we see, we're keeping a close eye on it, I guess, and the acquisition that we've made in TBS today is another little sort of toe in the water as we on the one hand, get some capacity in the German market that we need for video games. Its base business is subtitling and dubbing, or dubbing mostly for film and television content. So I think the answer is we're looking at it. We're not placing any major bets at the moment. Sorry, Ken.
Hi, Ken Rump from Jefferies. A couple of questions. Firstly, just to sort of perhaps clarify the kind of weighting of different comments you mentioned. I think you were keen to mention a couple of points. The light slate of games in the second half, which was evident at E3, and people clearly are saving a few things up for next year. To be as you said you expect to be at the kind of higher end of the range of consensus, that would seem to be around 315 million euros. That would still mean double-digit organic growth in the second half to me. So I think just in case anyone gets away with the idea that kind of it all grinds to a halt in the second half. Obviously, there's less acquisitions because you made them kind of around the middle of the year, and anything you do now is not going to make a big effect. But, you know, sort of slower is still a big number.
Yeah. Thanks for the clarification. That's helpful.
The second question I had was functional testing, to me, surprising. And I did see the mothership in Montreal, and they were in the process of taking another floor in that enormous building. Is it that the business is now big enough to do jobs that people wouldn't have offered them before? So it's a market share gain, which in a way, perhaps, as you say, is people maybe did them internally, but also I can't see where else you would have gone with, without mentioning any of the names, Leaping Lizards or whatever.
Yeah. No, I think it is a factor. So if you look at scale achieves a couple of things. One is it allows you to operate more efficiently, which means that either you can be more competitive in the market or you can get a little bit more margin. In our case, as you've seen, our margins have been fairly stable. So operationally, you get operational efficiency at scale. You also, of course, get to see more content and more experiences to how best to test things. You get better exposure to whether you're developing your own automation tools, which we do regularly to assist in the process, or it's clients' own automation tools that we're working with. All of that helps. And then the other thing is just the way in which you're perceived by your clients. If you have the ability to put on a team of 100 or 200 people from almost one day to the next, that's a capability that nobody else has in the market. So you then become a player for stuff that maybe before the client didn't appreciate could have been outsourced, that now can be outsourced, and that really helps. And then the simple thing is just becoming the experts, you know. So if you want, why try and maintain your own expertise if it can never be as good as, say, Keywords, because of just the sheer number of games that we're testing and the types of games and the different platforms and the compliance testing and the compatibility testing across devices. It's of a scale and a depth that is just unrivaled. So I think it's part of the story.
Sorry, now let's get final one, which is with a console changeover next year, with streaming coming in, that would normally imply a lot of porting type work, you know, in next year.
Yeah.
And actually you're having a busy time in testing this year, but that would be good for that part of the engineering, yeah?
Yeah, it's good for testing. In fact, as you port these games, they need to be tested. Platforms themselves, whether it's Google Stadia or Apple or whatever, they need to test those games before they go onto the platform. I'll leave it for you to decide how they get that work done. But, you know, there's a big testing company over here. And as you say, the porting work and the development work that it's all driving, those Stadia platforms, the arcade platform, these are new platforms, effectively. You then have the new consoles coming out. So proliferation of platforms, if you want to see it that way. But not only are they new platforms, they're platforms that give access to a far larger audience that will hopefully consume games in more and more languages as well. So I think it's all incredibly positive for Keywords.
Richard.
Richard Williamson from Edison. Just wanted to ask about M&A opportunities and what you're seeing in the market. Again, I recognise this has been a slightly slower period with smaller acquisitions, which is great to highlight the underlying organic growth. Yeah,
that's the upside of it.
I take that point. Yeah. But looking forward, are you seeing a more challenging acquisition market? Are you seeing multiples rising? Or is it very hard to generalise at this stage? And it's, you know, it is just an opportunistic approach.
Yeah. No, I mean, first of all, I like to think that we are anything but opportunistic. We have a very sort of targeted approach to the sorts of businesses we're looking at. We do our own origination. We're not sitting there waiting for things to come across our desk, really. Probably seen where the sort of multiples we've been paying for businesses that they haven't multiples haven't been rising. I'm not going to say they will never rise, but we don't see the pressure on acquisition prices today. I mean, the important thing that I think you need to remember is that the quality of a business that's acquired as a standalone business is a very different quality of business that it becomes once it's part of the Keywords under the Keywords umbrella. So things like client concentration, which is a problematic issue for a small standalone business, evaporates when it comes into the Keywords picture. So if you take a game development studio, it might have two or three contracts running. Each one of those contracts, if there's something goes wrong with one of those contracts, can be fairly disastrous for a standalone studio. So that's obviously reflected in the value that you would attribute to a standalone game development studio. But when it comes into Keywords, you have so much demand that should you have to unplug one contract and plug another one in, it's just a completely different risk profile. And in fact, moving from one contract to another, particularly in this market, gives you an opportunity to probably push your prices up a bit as well. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic. I don't know where to look, sorry. Fight amongst yourselves. I'll let Nessia choose.
Just you talked on pricing there. Is there anything you're currently doing in terms of price discriminating across the service lines, you know, since you've become more of an engineering-centric business, I suppose games development as it now is?
It depends what you mean by price discrimination,
so
I suppose.
I guess about cross service lines, you know, are you pricing appropriately to the service?
I think we're pricing appropriately to the service. So all our, you know, we don't operate in a bubble. So there are sort of market prices and market norms, some of which are a bit more transparent than others. So for instance, the pricing in game development is a little bit murkier than the pricing in, say, testing or localization, which is a bit more sort of established. You know exactly where you sit relative to a sort of market norm. You might be sort of asking as well is how sophisticated are we with our pricing? So for instance, if we're able to get multiple services across a client, does that mean that we can charge sort of less? The answer is it really depends on how that relationship is then put together. So individually, the services don't become more efficient just because you're selling six or seven services into a client. What becomes more efficient if you can get a sort of commitment from a client and you can start perhaps gaining share. So you increase the volume with client, you get closer to them, you get better visibility, you get more integrated delivery. Then you can sort of talk, you know, providing a discount in order to get that, either the longer term commitment or the increased volume.
And just one other question in relation to the console cycle. You know, usually it's about a 2-year period or so for a game to get up and running. Mm-hmm. So you'd imagine some of these games are already, you know, in progress. Are you seeing a huge, like how big is that versus cloud gaming, I guess, for Keywords in terms of the medium term, the new console?
I think, console games as a whole is obviously bigger than cloud gaming and so on. Yeah. So this is console games as a whole. I think what's happening this year, which is in stark contrast to what happened at the last console transition, is that you've got such a big install base of the current consoles. And I don't know if it's, I think it's the majority of games are probably running a bit of a services model where there is continuous content being uploaded or provided to those existing games on the existing console. I don't think many of our clients are going to want to cut off that revenue stream overnight. So they'll need support in supporting those existing games on existing consoles while they focus on producing content that shows off the capabilities of the new consoles. So I think this is going to be a smoother console transition and one in which we should see perhaps ultimately an increased demand for a period as we move between the previous generation and the new generation, which is a process that takes a couple of years anyway.
Thanks.
Hi, it's Natasha Brilliant from Citi. A couple of questions on the margin. Firstly, you've talked about the 15% next year, but how should we think about that across the different service lines? Can you just give us a bit of help in kind of, you know, how those margins split out?
Yeah, I would happily do so if I knew, but I don't. The way in which we run our business is we share the sort of facilities and that operating costs across the businesses, so we're not directly attributing them to each of the individual businesses. And it's easy to think that sort of we don't provide them, but the higher gross margin activities that you would expect from game development versus, say, player support, easy to make the assumption that that higher gross margin automatically drops to a higher net margin. It's not always the case, because in something like game development, you might have more of an issue with utilization and efficiently rolling staff from one project to another. You've got more of a sort of project nature to that, whereas something like player support is continuous business where you've got sort of 50 or 100 people supporting a game and you're billing them monthly. And your OPEX for player support can be much thinner than your OPEX for game development. So I'm not giving you an answer, but I'm just saying, even if I could, which I can't, I would be surprised if there's a massive difference on a net margin basis from service line to service line, just because of the what it takes to support them and the cost of the people in those various businesses and so on. So.
And then just a second question on sort of operational leverage, and again thinking about next year, we've had a couple of one-off factors this year at the margin. Is there a risk that if this sort of demand continues at this steep pace, actually ongoing investment will be needed and you'll sort of have a new level, I guess, of investment required to support that growth?
I think David can correct me, but I think, even though, for instance, we're talking about 1,400 workstations, the level of CapEx in the business is relatively light. I mean, we're talking something like
between 3-4% of revenues.
Yeah.
And it's still at that kind of run rate. H1 is more an issue of timing, where you'd see maybe a bit more in the second half than.
We always have the choice. We always can decide, we're going to invest behind the growth, or no, we're going to let it pass us by and benefit somebody else. I mean, my own preference is to continue to invest. We know it's a very profitable activity. The more scale you get, the more operational leverage you can get. It's not massive, but it all counts.
Just a couple of questions from me. So firstly, on the multimedia tax credits, can you just remind us how that's sort of recognized in the P&L versus the sort of offsetting costs associated, sort of operating costs with that, and how quickly you'll be able to get the cash from the multimedia tax credits, which is obviously building quite quickly through the cash flow?
I suppose going in reverse order, collection is effectively a year in arrears. So at the end of a fiscal year, what you see accrued on the balance sheet is effectively for that year in question. And we would traditionally collect that by the time it's gone through all its gating processes, traditionally again around October, November of the following year. So that's the collection cycle in terms of how we treat it. Again, we're offsetting it against the kind of employment costs of the people carrying out the activity. That's the treatment there against that from a P&L perspective.
Yes, there's no sort of transitionary period where there may be benefits or loss in, say, one half versus the other when credits are recognised versus the cost that's outlaid.
No, they're recognised as the work is done.
And then just one other thing, there was in the cash flow statement, there's a large sort of other receivables change. I was just wondering, one, what that is, and then as you get to the full year, where do you expect sort of net cash slash debt position to be at?
Yeah, other receivables, again, is part of a function of like the expansion, rental deposits, input taxes like VAT and purchase-related taxes that are reclaimable. Again, on a lot of the outfitting, fitting out, et cetera, that we've done. And then the underlying growth as well is, you know, a function of that. So you're seeing part of the increase in activity, and then you're seeing some specific stuff to the expansion.
Have you also got multimedia tax credits in the other receivables, maybe?
No, it's pretty sure it's separate.
Because it's separate, it's shown separate.
And then just last one, you're saying obviously the like-for-like growth's a bit cleaner for the moment, just purely because fewer acquisitions. What would the, if I was to ask the sort of true organic growth, if that makes sense, if you were to exclude all acquisitions in the last 12 months, how close or how clean is the 17.3%? If you know that off the top of your head.
I don't know it.
What the proportion of revenues from acquisitions is relatively minimal, so I think it's a relatively clean proxy as to being almost one and the same.
The other way I look at it, because I find it very difficult to strip out acquisitions because they're an integral part of the business. So, you know, if you start to strip them out, you're not looking at the business as it is today. But the other way of looking at it is pro forma growth. And if you sort of assume that you had the acquisitions for the full period, the full 6 months first, and you had them for the same full 6 months last year, I think that number is about 21%. So I don't know, you know, from depending on which way you do it, sometimes it's going to look better, sometimes it's going to look worse. But I think overall, the picture is one of, you know, astonishingly good organic growth, however you measure it. Oh, questions keep coming. Great.
Sorry, I'll keep it quick, Andrew. It's Neil Shah at Stiefel. So first question is just on automation. We hear a lot of talk about automation and software testing.
Yep.
What are you seeing in your market?
Yeah, it's very different from sort of enterprise software testing. Games are a very complex and evolving sort of creature. I think everybody, including ourselves, frankly, you know, would love to be able to automate more. We have no fear of automation. We have more than 20 people dedicated to automation engineers, test engineers within our business. The truth of the matter is there's only so much you can commercially, sensibly sort of automate in game testing because of the speed of the cycles and the way in which games change so rapidly. So by the time you've built your sort of automation harnesses and everything else that you need, it's almost too late, really. So, and also the complexity of games and they're almost too big to test in some cases. So you have to use currently what is really good human intelligence to try and figure out where you should be looking for issues, where you should sensibly looking for issues, and then concentrate resources in particular areas. And that's going to vary hugely from game to game.
And the second question was just on debt. What are you paying on the HSBC facility today? Your balance sheet looks underlevered, and would you explore using more debt in the future?
Roughly about 1.5%.
Yeah, about 1.5% above Euribor, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's a rolling credit facility. So it's got a lot of flexibility in it as well. In terms of the leverage, you know, we do generate good cash flows. We've consistently generated those cash flows. So I think it's a business that can certainly withstand a reasonable amount of debt. I think, you know, we haven't been shy of saying that we have an appetite to certainly use more debt than we have in the past. In the past, our balance sheet hasn't been leveraged at all. Today, it's fairly under-leveraged as well, if you want to look at it that way. But I don't think, you know, you should expect us to push anywhere beyond sort of 2x EBITDA anytime soon. But bear in mind that we're using a lot of that debt for acquisitions, which itself brings in EBITDA. So, you know, it's sort of self-fulfilling.
Hi there. Just two very quick ones on the game development segment. First was The current game development hubs appear to be in sort of very high wage areas. So you've got San Francisco, you've got Brighton as well. Just wondering, is there an opportunity to maybe look to develop some centres within maybe India or somewhere like that and get some of the lower creative work going over there instead, trying to drive margins that way, or is that just a function of being a AAA game developer? And the second question I had was, game development and outsourcing still around 20%. Is there an opportunity to look to accelerate that outsourcing share by driving share capture, reducing margins potentially on the game development side of it, or are you just protecting ROI?
Both good questions. So in terms of high cost versus low cost location for game development, the issue is, cost is not only about the cost that, the day rate or the per day or per month cost of your developers or something. It's also about the capabilities of your developers. So the capabilities need to come first, because, if you've got a bunch of very inexperienced game developers or people that haven't done game development before but are good software developers, that's not necessarily what you need to deliver against the requirements. And the other thing is that, proximity to clients still counts for a lot. There's a lot of sort of interpretation that goes into how you develop a game, and being culturally, close to your client is quite valuable as well. So I wouldn't undervalue having game development centers in high cost centers if that's where the client is and that's where the talent is. But I think our big opportunity is to work in a distributed fashion. So you can have the sort of spearhead in a high cost center like a, we don't have them currently, but let's say like a Los Angeles or a San Francisco or a London Brighton sort of thing, and then work in a distributed fashion where we can leverage our resources in Poland, Russia, ultimately lower cost centers even beyond that. But it isn't something that we must do today in order to play in the market. It's something which directionally we would like to move to. We're starting to work more in a distributed fashion across the studios that we've got already. And our clients are appreciating that sort of additional capacity that it brings and that capability that it brings. And I think, given we've got a very strong presence in China, for instance, we've got a very strong presence in India. If there are opportunities for us to create sort of offshore engineering capabilities on the back end of some of the projects we do, we'll certainly be looking at that. In terms of margin, I can't see any good argument for dropping price in game development in order to capture more market share, because the problem really isn't that. The problem is in staffing it. The problem is in how much resource can you hire, how quickly, and how quickly can you cement it together in a team, and then perform the work at the sort of quality and efficiency levels that we used to do. So the challenge isn't really one of speed in terms of accelerating speed by reducing price. It's the challenge is one of speed in terms of finding the resources and growing into the demand.
Thank you. Two more questions on the game development services line. Firstly, just on that pricing point, you actually say in your prepared comment that pricing increases will start to flow through,
yep.
In fact. Mm-hmm. So if you could just talk a little bit both about the internal and external drivers for that,
yeah.
And then I'll hold the second question.
Yeah, so I think I mentioned that pricing in game development is a little bit more opaque than it is in some of our other services. So obviously what we do in sort of acquiring these businesses is we find we acquire businesses that are maybe working with the same clients or on similar projects, but at a different price point. There's obviously an opportunity for some pricing equalization as we do that. So the market knowledge we have of where market price lies or where it can lie is
significantly enhanced within Keywords relative to any of the individual studios. So this is not something where you go in, you know, with a sort of bulldozer approach and just raise all your prices tomorrow. It's really as you cycle off from one project to another, as you're bidding on the next project, we're basically bidding at a higher price than we would have done a year or so ago. And so it's a continual process of moving price into the demand and into the growth.
A second question, just so I understand a little bit better about your game development business, is it more about doing end-to-end development on a fixed price contract, or is it more about selling time and capacity?
Yeah, we are hugely in favour of time and material work. Fixed price comes with risk, which, you know, given that we don't share the rewards with the developer, we don't particularly want to share the share the risk either. So we would rather be paid for the work we do at a decent price than share the risk on those contracts. So we don't see particular logic in us chasing a whole bunch of fixed price work.
Would it be right to assume, therefore, that you don't have milestone deliverables if you prefer that route?
Yeah, it depends. So if you look at the way most of our contracts are structured, they're more sort of around monthly deliveries rather than, you know, your you know, one third, two thirds, final sort of deliveries.
I'll just sneak one last one. You mentioned when you depict your game development business as having several elements of proprietary software. Mm. Does that include a proprietary game development engine?
It actually does, but I wouldn't get hugely excited about it. So we do have our own game engine. So D3T came to us with a game engine that they use, and actually that engine has been used to ship games, including fairly recently. But I'm, you know, please don't think of it at all in the same sort of category as an Unreal or a Unity or anything like that. It's not that sort of thing, but it is a well-developed sort of code base on which you can run and ship games.
Thank you.
Andrew, you touched on the streaming services a few times, and have you got a view on how successful you think they might be in the next, say, year or two, given the high-speed internet connections that the players need? Would the streaming services change the way your clients need to operate and therefore change the way they interface with you guys?
This is one of the things I like about Keywords, is I don't have to worry too much about how successful those particular platforms are going to be. We get paid whatever. Having said that, I have to believe that with the sort of commitments being made by Google and others to streaming, Microsoft, of course, and who knows what Amazon and others are going to be doing in the space, that a lot of the technical challenges have been overcome and will continue to be overcome. So perhaps, you know, in the early phases of streaming, it's going to work better for some consumers than for others. But I think with the advent of proper 5G and everything else, it's going to become much more universal, I would assume. And therefore, you know, why shouldn't you be able to play a game on any device from anywhere as long as you've got an internet connection? And I think that's directionally the way the business is going. It's the way we all thought it would go sort of 10 years ago. It's just taken a bit longer than it has for music or film and TV content. But it seems inevitable that that's where it's going. Whether it goes, you know, how fast it goes in that direction is, well, I'm not going to sort of speculate. So that was one. Did you have a second part? Sorry, Tom.
Is there anything, does it change the behavior of your clients, the fact that the games are all streaming, and then does that change the way it interfaces with you?
Yeah, it can do. I think streaming itself, not necessarily, but what some streaming platforms will do is allow you to be far more integrated than before, and to have larger
content. So whether it's using the power of the cloud to make your game universe much, much bigger than you're able to make if you're confined to the capacity of an individual console machine or something, or if it's the fact that you can now sort of integrate with YouTube or, you know, different services out there through the cloud infrastructure. The more connected these experiences become, the more support they require, the more testing they require, the more customer support issues you generate, and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, that will generate further demand for our services in addition to what I've said in terms of the language mix.
Thank you. Anik Hack from Citi. Andrew, maybe just a question on cross-sell. So about 100-odd customers getting more than three services, but you've got almost 900 customers there in total. Yeah. You mentioned simplification of some of the business lines. Can we maybe, just trying to understand a little bit better how big you think the opportunity is, and how perhaps you can go about accelerating it? Because obviously there's a lot of complexity within the business through the M&A that's been built.
Yeah, so what I'm... you know, we talk about sort of cross-selling, so from a client perspective, but, you know, you've also got this other thing going on, which is, like I showed at the beginning with the trailer business, where you're actually joining the dots internally between different service lines as well to create a package delivery. So I think there are great opportunities on both those fronts. I think as we, as a business evolve and as our clients evolve and start to sort of engage with us in a more structured fashion across service lines, because a lot of our clients are still engaging on a separate service basis, as they start to engage across multiple services, we'll be able to invest more heavily in account management and so on and so forth. And I think that will further accelerate cross-selling as well. So I think there's a huge opportunity. I mean, even in our biggest clients that are buying seven or more services, I mean, the penetration that we have in terms of their total outsourcing needs or in terms of their what they could in future outsource is relatively small.
Ken Rump again. I would be remiss to let David get away from his last results meeting without a detailed analysis of IFRS 16. No. please no. Yeah. Just coming back perhaps to the question of net debt, you made the point that you historically always tended to generate more cash in the second half. You've got some of the deferred payments that are visible due to come out. Adding that up, you know, heading towards kind of a balance of debt and cash by the end of the year, absent further acquisitions and depending kind of how busy you are at the end of December in a sense, but as a sort of broad guide, sort of heading towards zero.
No. Yeah, I mean, again, it's contingent on a couple of factors that can sway you
definitely
either. So,
a few million leeway either way.
I mean, the other thing we didn't kind of touched on, but we're starting to get momentum in terms of starting to implement and leverage a kind of a banking network that we've built. You know, start to look at cash pooling on a more effective basis now that that's kind of layered out, help improve the liquidity, you know, and manage the cash better in a more systematic way. So, I mean, I think if you're plus five, minus five, broadly speaking, that's probably...
Okay. I was just going to ask one last one. One of the points also that you made was that you've effectively got some kind of startup operations like Yokozuna and Get Social, which, you know, inevitably either they're going to work or they're not, you're going to stop doing them.
Yeah.
They're also probably businesses that would ultimately have software type margins, not, so to speak, service type margins. Yeah. Where sort of are we and, you know, what's the sort of path towards commercialization?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think the way I would address it is twofold. Yes, we have been investing in some more sort of technology type businesses. I think you should expect us to continue to do that. You know, to the extent that we can use technology to provide better services to our clients or actually just provide that technology directly to the clients, if they don't have sort of direct access to it elsewhere, we'll happily do that. Some of them are very early stage businesses, as you say. Some of them have yet to prove themselves, but that's not going to necessarily stop us investing in technology businesses going forward. We think there is a good marriage between some technology and the service that goes alongside them.
How long you give them to prove themselves, it's horses for courses, really. So I'm sure David and John in future will be sort of questioning, how, at what point we decide whether we've got a really viable, vibrant business coming out of these units, or whether we should, reconsider our ongoing investment in them or not. But yeah, it's difficult to say exactly what the timeline is.
Thanks.
I think we're at the final question, aren't we?
Sorry, just one final, hopefully short question. Just want to ask about the problematic project that you acquired.
So yes.
Touching on the game dev side earlier. In terms of, essentially, it's either behind in terms of quality or over in terms of cost, I presume one or the other.
The latter.
What can you do to sort of remedy that? And how big a drag is it going to be?
Why
wasn't it identified DD as well? Sorry.
Damn. That was the question I was hoping not to get. That's a good question. And perhaps there's a lesson for us for future DD operations. I think a game development project is very complex. I think a lot of our clients would readily admit to not getting budgets right on game development projects, because it's very hard to know what you're dealing with at the start. Now, this is not exactly in that category. I think we could have done a better job of scoping it and pricing it correctly. This is sort of on us, particularly, I would say. It's not an issue of quality or capability, and it's not a project that's leading to any sort of acrimonious behavior between us and client. We fully accept that we took the project on, and we need to deliver, and we're making very good progress. So the resources that have been committed to that project are starting to ramp off as we get closer to the end of the project. And they are obviously being reassigned to, normal, profitable level contract work. So the effect of that is starting to unwind. Due diligence. I mean, this is a project that was signed fairly soon before the sale of the business, and it for the development company itself, it takes a lot of time and effort and resource to fully scope out a project. For us to be able to do that during due diligence may be hard to expect, but obviously we know there's risk in fixed price contracts. We try and avoid them. Perhaps seeing this one in the mix, we should have perhaps spent a bit more time looking at it. And the other thing you can ask yourself is, maybe we should have cut our losses early on, because with these sort of things, if you realize you're in that situation, there's sometimes a way out early on. There really very rarely is later on. You sort of have to get to the end of it. Are we through? Great. Time for a glass of water. Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.